You can drop me a WhatsApp, 072-567-1567. We spent a great deal of this morning talking about gun violence. Gangsterism and gangs are a large part of organized crime, street crime here in the city. That gets coupled with the law, L-O-R-E, of gangsterism and gangs in the city and around this country. The mythology that is created around gangs and gangsterism, whether they be street gangs or whether they be prison gangs. We're often talking about the numbers gang that are deeply entrenched in South African prisons, the 26s to the 27s, the 28s. And this thing bleeds onto what is discussed and what is the lived experience of many people on the street in the places in which they live. So we thought we'd get some of the background of gangs and gangsterism in this city and also in our prison system. Today on the history of, we are talking about the history of gangs in Cape Town with specific reference to street gangs as well as the numbers gang in South African prisons and how they are connected. Jeremy Very joins us on the line. Still involved in his case to return to the South African Police Service, former head of detectives in the Western Cape, and at the same time written quite extensively and researched quite extensively on the history of gangs and gangsterism in the city of Cape Town. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Morning Review again. I hope you are well.
I'm well. Good morning to you and the listeners.
Is gangs and gangsterism as Cape Town as Table Mountain is to the city, as Snook is to fishing communities, is gangsterism and gangs simply just part of who we are in the city?
No, they're not part of who we are, but they are a reflection of how we've sacrificed governance to organize crime. And how, as a community, we failed to organize ourselves like we did under apartheid to deal with something that has privatized our freedom of movement in gang-ridden areas, our freedom of association in those areas, and our basic right to safety and security to such an extent that one can say they oppress us and our people as much as apartheid did before in terms of those basic rights being affected. So gangs, as always, also affected the quality of our freedom in areas where they are dominant. So I won't say one should adopt a fatalistic approach that they will be there forever. We are allowing them to be there forever. Not only through law enforcement, which is a narrow view of looking at it, but through the power we cede to our own children in these structures, to our own uncles and our own fathers who run these gangs. Mm. And the fact that we, in some cases, peg our survival, whether we want to send our kids pay a bursary or whether we owe money somewhere, our whole economic welfare is entwined in some places with what gangs have to offer. So I hate the fatalistic view that says that they'll be there forever. It is determined by us. Mm. We are the human agency involved in the continued existence of this.
What then is the recorded history of not only just organized crime and as you would find in any societies through colonialism into a form of modern history, the growth, the simultaneous growth of governments and structures along with organized, you know, crime and banditry and what other collusion. But here, specifically in the city of Cape Town, when do we first see the emergence of what we come to know as gangs and gangsterism?
Okay, what we look in the District 6 of old, we had the Globe gang and those particular formations that involved around the running of the collection of rent for Jewish property owners who own most of the property in which District 6 was, as it was before, that more flats and all those kind of areas, where they could not risk going in to collect the thing. So these people did collection for them. People like the Globe and all those the Stalag 17s later, in later years, in what is called Bungalow 17, that this was a particular section of District 6, is the forerunner of the mongrels. So we're talking about things that go back to the 40s and the 50s. But if we're talking about prison gangs in particular and them coming here, okay, to this thing, they first basically set their foot in two central prisons, and not as a result of emerging organically here. And that is the early Tukai prison, which later became the Portsmouth prison, Robben Island, that was always there, and it's a criminal prison also, the criminal section, and then Belleville prison, which was in the quarry area of Fort Trekker Road as you cross over into Belleville. Now, how the numbers gang came there is quite an interesting story. In the KZN, Newcastle area, and in what is now would be Mpumalanga and in around the mines on the reef, there was, in the late 1800s to early 1900s, a group calling themselves Umkhozi Wezintaba, Regiment of the Hills. Now, this was a group of people run by a chap who was called Jan Noorte, but he was actually, it was called Nongaloza, let's say. And this person ran a group of bandits, okay, who used to do two things, rob payrolls of mines, rob mine workers who trek from the mines, especially towards the end of the year, back to the Eastern Cape or to KZN in particular. They would organize waylay robberies at certain key routes and rob also them. They were also involved in housebreaking on the area, and they liaised with certain syndicates, especially the Irish bandit groups, the ex-soldiers, later after the Second World War, who stayed here and became masked highwaymen, robbers, in terms of access to fencing some goods that they would get that. So this was an outside phenomena first. They formed a structure that was more or less the semblance of the 27 gang, soldiers, men of blood, and the 28s, the people who look after the domestic affairs in the caves, or literally in the underground of the sewers of the Rand at the time, the Joburg area. So this is where it starts. However, in the early 1900s,
Jeremy Vieira there, looks like we've lost him, but let's see if we can get him back on the line. In the meantime, let's maybe go to a quick voice note and see what... Actually, let me read a message quickly as we wait for Jeremy Vieira to get back on the line. Hi, Lester. A very rough calculation based on confirmed losses of our information and guns by the state versus the number of murders leads to basically a gun with a full clip for every murder. Good show from John in Tableview. Thanks so much for that. Here's another message here that says, all talk regarding gangs in Cape Town. World wars have been resolved, but nobody can stop the gangs because they don't want to. Simple as that. As too many high officials will lose too much money. 021-446-0567 as we try to get Jeremy Vieira back on the line. Let's go to a voice note. Let's listen to that one. You want us?
Hi, Lester. Good morning. I'm only catching the tail end of your interview with Jeremy Vieira. I'm not on your show. He's written the book called Gang Town, highlighting the history of gangsterism in Cape Town and broader South Africa, as well as the far-reaching effects that it has on our people, on our economy, on our mothers, on our children, on our family life, etc. I think it's a good read. I'll highly recommend it to anybody that's interested in wanting to know so much more about the enlightening world of gangsterism. But it doesn't only focus on gangsterism, as I've mentioned. It covers so many vast areas, childhood development, adolescence, early teens, adults, and the like. I would highly recommend it to anybody who wants to show a keen interest in researching the topic further. A very well-researched book. Big ups to Don Pinnock. Thanks. Cheers from Delano.
Thanks, Delano. It's a really, really great book. Don Pinnock had been on other shows on Cape Town, Cape Talk before. I'm sure that that interview with him, I think the last time he was on was with John Matham talking about his book, Gangtown. I'm sure you can just Google, maybe find it on our website, and then you can listen to that. But Jeremy Veery, back on the line. Sorry, you cut out there, Jeremy. You were talking about the history of the Numbers Gang, its connection, particularly first to the reef, the mines, highway robberies in Johannesburg, making its way into KZN, what is now KZN. But how does it then find itself infiltrated in
that's what I want to get to. After the I told you about the murder of a police officer, the white one, and two what they call native police officers, the Transvaal Commissioner of Police, the ZABS back then, together with the Cape Colony, the colonial police, they decided they're going to round up all of Umkhuzi Vezintaba and they must arrest Nongolos. They chased them all over into Free State, KZN, and rounded up a substantial amount of them and put them in Cinderella Prison and Barberton Prison in that parts of the country, the northern parts of the country. Thereafter, they were realizing the Transvaal Commission of Prisons at that time that after taking a statement from Nongolosa himself, he explains his gang, that this gang was now permeating all prisons in the Western Cape and the KZN area, particularly Point Road Prison. Okay? And that this gang was non-racial in the first place. They then decided, given this influence and the way they were corrupting influence on the prisons there, they're going to transfer all these people to Cape Town, most of them. And most of the leadership were broken up. By then, they had in prison divided into the 27, 26s, and 28s. The Nongolosa, of course, was kept up there. And most of his gang was then transferred to Bellville, Simonian Prison, to Robben Island, and to Tukai Prison in particular. And it is there, while there were other gangs like gangsters arrested from the Globe Gang, and now we're dealing with the late 30s, the early 30s, 20s, 20s, 30s. And it's there where it started gaining a foothold as a dominant gang culture. It came with its own system of governance. It has its own magistrates, its own soldier army. It has its own social infrastructure. So it was really a total package that any prisoner can go into to survive. It comes with a total philosophy of the Numbers Gang with its own languages. Nyaza for the 28s. Salasiza for the 27s and Shalambomo for the 26s. So it really attracted people who had been deculturized by, similar to other parts of the country, by urbanization and that kind of situation. So the type of people who landed up there, and this offered a source of survival in prison and offered access to privileges. And whatever gets smuggled in via the 26, if you get a 26, because it's a job of the 26 to make money, like they say, Kruendenzula met Masholo. They make money through the use of their mind or rob you in sly particular ways. The 28s are people of roof and plunder, Bolfang. So they rob you straightforward, hard, with has no attempt to conjure that. Where the 27 are strictly men of blood, they particularly engage in war or mediation if there's conflict between the 28s and the 26s. So you, as prisoners in the Western Cape, people were absorbed into this particular structure. And from that, the rest is history. So most, whenever a person goes to prison, even today, and they say, you can't mark and do what you will. This is your master, you see. So what they do is they dissolve your previous gang identity. They even inspect the doctor or Nyangi inspects your tattoos to see whether you have false tattoos or whatever, and where you come from, so that history of yours outside is wiped out for the purpose of your new identity inside. I mean, to use their symbolism, they say, they would say, in other words, your perception, your vision is now the vision of the number. And they would say, which means that once you step in, there's no way of getting out there.
Jeremy Vere, I want to continue this conversation with you just after Eyewitness. Welcome back. We're still speaking to Jeremy Vere. We're talking about the history of gangs, particularly the history of the Numbers Gang in South African prisons, which has infiltrated, one would argue, every single correctional services facility around the country. I know that we have two semi-private prisons, I think one in the Free State and one in the Northern Cape. Would it be far-fetched to say that the number has infiltrated every single correctional services or even private prison in South Africa, Jeremy?
Yes, that is fair to say. And to my knowledge, even the private prison that you're talking about, as I have no particular case studies there. But I think if one wants to understand the contemporary power of these people, you know, I was summoned to testify as an expert witness on them in February 2015. Now, this related to a long marathon case where all three number chapter gangs from the 28, 26, together with their leadership in prison, about 231 of them, took and on the correctional services minister and the president and demanded 250 million in compensation. Now, what had happened is one of their generals on the 28th side had stabbed a warder, Babini Nkakula, who is related to Nkakula, to the minister in particular, in St. Albans prison in June 2005. There was a response to them that resulted in prisoners' bones being broken and severe bruises and that. And words were being bandied around, like the correctional services conducted a venge-driven paramilitary operation with non-standard weapons against innocent prisoners. Now, they would have lost this. So what I had to demonstrate in my thing is that they actually organized themselves as an army in response to the correctional services. And because I had experience of the way they prepare themselves for war, they call it the British, I was able to illustrate from watching the videos and going into the prison itself that people, for example, had their clothes padded, which is a standard number thing. If you're going to war, Britishing yourself, people had.
Is that where the saying comes from? You just heard your uncle saying this. Dukke British.
Say Dukke British. In other words, you pair that you're preparing for war. Mm. I could demonstrate for my knowledge, also having been in prison before, awaiting trial in a number section before I went to Roman Island. I could, for example, illustrate that in the structure of entering a cell when people are at war, you will see the captain one, which is the Tandolo of the twin, standing up front, silently watching and observing, the intelligence officer, in other words, the inspector one, Imangacha, sort of inspecting and observing the threats that come. And immediately in the first set of beds, standing up straight, of course, British, you would see the soldiers in various order of ranks and the generals and the commissioned officers right at the back. And in some cases, the gov, as they call the government, right at the back. So that posturing, if you read it correctly, immediately, I was able to explain, was a posture of war.
Mm.
Therefore, the force that was required to deal with them was the type of force that would be fit to entering a military military sortie.
Jeremy, I want to take you back to what you said about being a political prisoner in South Africa. And take a step backwards. And we look at the role of prison gangs as an almost quasi anti-colonial fight within the prison system. And how do they then identify that all of a sudden, after 1976, you have a lot of young political prisoners coming into a system? What then is the discussion that happens in an awaiting trials section? You were on Robben Island as well. What is then the discussion that happens?
Let me tell you what happened to two people. The one is, we were the only people that were ever kept in Section 29 in the middle of a gang section. Everybody else was kept at stations. It's myself and now ex-General Mpholi Sekhutani. We were there around about the same time, Section 29. We were seen, because Madiba was in the section next door, of course isolated, we were seen as men of blood. In other words, because we were seen as soldiers of Nkuntu Sizwe, we were regarded and revered by the 27th gang. Okay? So that is how we were seen. I was, for example, by a 27 Lord, which is one of the highest ranks, I was given what they call knives from the oven. In other words, the best made knives I had in my possession to protect, because I'm a soldier, to defend myself like any 27 would. So somehow they attached some, they mythologized because of Madiba, and I'm going to see they mythologized some of us who had been awaiting trial there. Now, an example of how they saw us is, you know, in my first book, I deal with a situation where one of the guys, prisoners, ordinary prisoners who were brought up the food usually, to us when we were now all together in Portsmouth on the roof in a collective cell, just before his release, him and his lover, his wife, if you should put it that way, got a death sentence. And it was so serious that we were woken up at about 2 o'clock in the morning, all of us, Peter Jacobs, Anodam, all of us, and asked, did any one of us give the numbers gangs, because they all sat together, the leadership, we call them their circles of number one, Sunambinini. They all the Sunambinini sat together, and they decided to honor us. The blood of these two people must be taken. And, you know, we were trying to figure out now exactly where it is. Until we discovered that one of us, Wally Ruda, for example, was asked while he was walking in the hospital section for something, he went there. He was asked by some old man sitting there, listen, how's things are there? So he started complaining, and which was right to complain at the time, listen to the food and those things. And they were very upset. He didn't know he was talking to a senior general in the 27th gang. So what happened is the death sentence was immediately pronounced, and the only way we could stop it is by ourselves going down to go and speak to the numbers gang. So you imagine 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, some of us were taken out of ourselves to go and speak to the leadership of the 27s, 28s, and 27s. And tell them, look, while we appreciate the gesture, we are honored by it, it is not necessary. As soldiers, we will solve our own problems.
Mm.
So that also gives you an indication of the depth of what we're talking about. We're talking about a subculture that has endured years, years, and continues to resurrect itself. And one of the most dangerous things about it, what it does to street gangs, it gives when they come out, some of these leaders, the rules have changed. Now, if you got it, became a general inside, you're going to accept people to respect you as that when you're outside.
Then how does
that's
then
what often drives conflict?
Then how then does this outside glamorization, popularization of what is essentially prison law, which is essentially a context which thrives in the context of a then colonial prison system, which does not necessarily have the same role and responsibilities under this democratic dispensation. How does that then affect what we see outside street gangs, which are essentially also then connected to an international narco criminal economy?
Look, the first thing is to understand that those gangs, whether it's the prison gangs or outside, they bring an alternative form of belonging in a vacuum where such belonging does not come with normal social rights of passage to adulthood. So the only people, when you come out there collectively showing a sense of identity that is attached with belonging, displaying it on the street every time, having their own code of conduct, wearing their own clothes, all of them, you see literally them, the gangs. But with the number system, it goes further beyond the visual. The number system gives you the philosophy. It gives you a complete code of conduct, a complete history of its own culturally. It gives you a complete philosophy or belief system with which you behave as a member of the numbers game. So in a situation culturally where this, as a result of decimation and oppression, those environments have been entirely deculturized. There's no such sense of belonging that is offered other than by them. And that is where I say we have a community responsibility and education to start building those. So that's at the cultural level. Yeah. But at an economic level, you know, we have other gangs in the from internationally. We have the 14KL triad, we have the Washing War triad, we have the Cosa Nostra, we have the Russian mafia, we have everyone you can think about in Cape Town. Okay? But I can assure you, if you want to navigate the underworld in this province, you do so through the gangs. You cannot go and run solo without making a deal with gangs. As many of our drug smugglers of Nigerian origin, for example, have discovered initially in Sea Point when they were just shot in broad daylight in the early 90s for dealing in coke until they made a compromise. Those are the kind of, you need to navigate through them. When you want to deal, get your abalone out of Austin, you can't get your abalone out of Austin without the 28. If you're the 14K out triad or the Washing War triad, you must navigate that. Otherwise, they rob you or they are quickly inclined to deal with you violently.
Jeremy,
I
need to wrap up this conversation. It's deeply gripping and I think an external...
And we're a good hitman, eh? Don't mistake. We get hired people from the Cape Flats to go do hits in Joburg to do hits against...
I feel that we need to do a separate pre-recorded podcast that we can just put on externally, so we're not trapped by the commercial imperatives of doing ads and do all those things. But there are two trains of thought that are coming through on the WhatsApp line, and I'd like your response very briefly on this. There's one that says blaming the gang problem on apartheid is pure nonsense and an opportunistic attempt to stir up racial divide. And there's, in the same vein, an opposite thought saying, so are you telling us, Jeremy, that it would be in all likelihood that if apartheid didn't exist in South Africa, that we would not be seeing an as great a gang problem? I'd just like your thought to
coalesce. I'm not saying it's apartheid. Mm-hmm. In actual fact, I took you to a history that goes to the late 1800s. But what I told you is a common factor. Mm. The dislocation of communities that came with urbanization in our early history. It was de-acculturation that came with the old cultural systems and glues being that form that drove social and strong social identities being totally decimated. Mm. Now, that would have happened under capitalism, whether or not early capitalism, colonial capitalism, whether or not formal apartheid existed at that time or not. It did not necessarily exist in the same form later. Mm. So nobody's blaming apartheid. In actual fact, the same type of dislocation and marginalization and those factors even exist today and are being reproduced today in our society.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have the type of unemployment that is bred by that exists now, that existed then too, in Manenberg, well, it becomes a difficult, it's a matter of choice though, but it becomes a very difficult choice if in front of you you can see an alternative of belonging that can come with new wealth.
Yeah. Jeremy Vera, unfortunately we've run out of time. Really appreciate it. I think I want to arrange a separate chat with you so we can put a conversation or a masterclass in its totality somewhere on our website, on a podcast, so we flesh out many of these themes uninterrupted. But thank you so much. A lot of appreciation on the WhatsApp line. A message here from Neil in Bellville says, absolutely incredible topic and interview. I'm captured by the words of your guest's lips. Absolutely incredible. I will agree with you there, Neil. Thank you so much.